Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS, FM, and HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. You know, one of the many benefits I get from having a partner at James Madison's Montpelier is that the folks out at Montpelier sometimes give me a call and they'll ask me to go speak at this or that place, or they'll ask me to go and attend this or that conference. And a month or two ago, they asked me to go and moderate a panel discussion for the Association of the Virginia State Police, their annual meeting, a very important group to learn about the Constitution. I mean, these guys carry badges and guns. They enforce the Constitution every day. So I was very happy to go. I love cops, and I love talking to cops. And while I was there, I had the pleasure of meeting several interesting people. And among them was a particularly interesting guy. His name is Michael Meyerson. And Mike is a professor of law at the University of Baltimore School of Law. And I'm going to give him the highest compliment I can think of. He reminds me of me. He has exactly the same sorts of interests and many of the same perspectives I do. And he taught me all kinds of interesting things. I don't generally like just sitting and listening to other people. I'm like most of us. I'd rather talk than listen. But no, I liked listening to Mike. And after his presentation, I was so impressed that I said, Mike, tell me more. And he did. And he shared with me the fact that he's just recently completed a book. And it's a marvelous book. It's called Endowed by Our Creator. And it is a study of what the founders, several founders, some of the most prominent founders, actually said and thought about freedom of religion. Now, this is a very timely topic. I know it's a couple hundred years old and all that, but oftentimes we hear people say the founders thought this or the founders thought that. And really, very few of the people who make such statements, it seems to me, have actually gone back and read what the founders said and analyzed it in context and really looked at it objectively and tried to figure out what they were telling us all those years ago. But Mike has done that. And so without further ado, Mike Meyerson of the University of Baltimore and his new book, Endowed by Our Creator.
Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Now, I understand that you have written a new book called Endowed by Our Creator. What's that all about?
Well, the subtitle is The Birth of Religious Freedom in America.
Mm-hmm.
And what I wanted to do was explore all the myths, all the partisan takes on history, to find out exactly how did we in America create this extraordinarily successful experiment in religious freedom.
Well, but Michael, I thought that was clear. They were all a bunch of demigods anointed by God himself, and they all thought exactly the same thing, didn't they?
Almost. Well, actually, what's interesting is they're not demigods, they're not perfect, but they were incredibly wise. The best of them were both wise and decent. And so we have a lot to learn just because they thought about issues like religion and pluralism and government in ways far better than we do today. And they disagreed and they changed over time. But there's a real sense of we can learn a lot from listening to their internal dialogues and their letters and their public speeches and public actions.
Well, by all means, proceed then. Share with us some of the things that you learn and you explain in your book about those documents and those statements that these founders made.
Well, there are a lot of short versions. One of the short versions to think about is that they very much were aware, as a starting point, that religion could be a force for tremendous good or tremendous evil.
Mm-hmm.
And led by, of all people, George Washington, an underestimated hero in the story of religious freedom, they decided, and I'm talking now about Madison, Jefferson, Ben Franklin, and George Washington in particular, but others, that religion should be a force that united the nation and not divided it.
Mm.
And so they did not want to scrub all dialogue of and mention of religion and God out of public discourse. And one of the things about those who consider themselves, shall we call them, Jeffersonians, people believe in a rigid separation of church and state, is they get upset if there's any mention by a politician of God. And the reality is, even Jefferson would discuss, say a prayer for me in his speeches and would thank God when a smallpox epidemic spared a city. So these people were not afraid to mention religion, but they also, it was never a Christian nation. It was never viewed that way. Our leaders never described us that way. So there was a sense that they understood that when religion and government mixed, it tended to be very, very bad, very, very sectarian, very, very, very dangerous for unity. But at the same time, they developed a vocabulary that permitted them to discuss religion in a unifying way.
That is quite a balancing act, Michael. How in the world did they achieve that? On the one hand, you know, saying that there is a role for religion in our public life, so we don't want to kick God out of the public square, so to speak. But on the other hand, staying away from the sectarian problem. How did they manage to do that?
Well, I think in part they did it because they really believed it.
Mm-hmm.
They really believed in it. So when George Washington is giving his Thanksgiving address, he says, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God." Now notice, he changes language from the way the Continental Congress had its Thanksgiving. They used to say, "It is the duty of all men to thank God." And Washington never says, "We all must pray a certain way." So number one, they acknowledge that there is a difference. Their vocabulary was intended to be inclusive. So George Washington is writing to each of the different religions, religious leaders, if you will, and saying, "You are part of the American fabric." So when he issues a call for Thanksgiving, for example, synagogues join in because they feel they are included in this sort of discussion. So he tried very hard, and one of the things is they were completely non-denominational. So even, I mean, the title of my book, Endowed by Our Creator, is kind of a shout-out to the Declaration of Independence, which was very, very, very specific in not being specific to any given religion.
Right. Now, that's a very interesting thing. In fact, I've heard it said, and I haven't done the research the way you have, so you can confirm or contradict this. I've heard it said that Washington typically referred to religion in very generic terms, such as like providence.
Yes.
Or our creator. You know, he would, or the most specific he would ever get is God.
I think that's correct. He would. It was during the Revolutionary War when he was commander in chief. Occasionally, he would make reference to Christian soldiers. And once or twice, he would write in letters language that was clearly Christian in its nature, in its reference. Yet, when he became president, he never once used any language that could be called denominational. I think he was so aware that religion could be divisive. And because he was the first person to think of America as a union, he saw the different religions. He knew that religion could be divisive. So he never, once he became president, used any language that would be considered exclusionary.
Right. In fact, that's always been something that struck me, is that people who are more on the accommodationist side, or perhaps maybe even, you know, very zealous Christian advocates, the people who claim that we're a Christian nation, I always wonder when I hear that, if in fact we were, why was Jesus never mentioned in the Constitution?
God isn't literally mentioned in the Constitution either.
Right, yeah.
There's a couple of aspects of that. First of all, one of the things I learned in my book, and this is why I say we were never, ever a Christian colony, state, or nation, is because those who began our country were virulently, horribly, bigoted anti-Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
And, in fact, there's this incredible letter from the Continental Congress to the people of England calling Catholicism a language that leads to murder, superstition, impiety. So there was a real... So if you consider Christian, sort of to include Catholics and other less favored denominations, then there was never that sense of being a Christian nation. I do think the nation, by the time we won the Revolutionary War, considered itself, I mean, at least the government... considered itself like mostly Protestant, expected within certain range a certain amount of belief. But there was a radical change between the end of the Revolutionary War and the writing of the Constitution.
Huh.
Some people, led by James Madison, who is, again, the leader, along with Thomas Jefferson, of just really thinking about how to be a free nation, a pluralistic nation, without government harming religion. There had been a big fight over whether there should be a tax on all Virginians to pay for Christian teachers.
Mm-hmm.
And Patrick Henry of Revolutionary Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death fame was in favor of a tax to support Christian teachers. James Madison led the fight against it. And I think people like Madison and George Washington got educated that religious battles are the ugliest battles in history.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they became very, very... So by the time the Constitution is being drafted, there is a sense that the government should not be putting its weight, its power, its threatening power on the side of one part of a religious debate or another. So I think that probably the most important part of the Constitution is one that people don't really remember, is the part of the Constitution that says there shall never be a religious place for public office.
Mm-hmm.
This is what people don't grasp, but the significance is almost every state at the time had some religious requirement. It could be a very narrow Protestant. It could be Pennsylvania's belief in God. But almost every state had a religious test. And yet when the United States is formed, they decide in this incredibly universalist way that no one should be excluded for lack of a particular religious faith. And that statement, I think, was sort of meant as part of the attempt to unify.
Yep, that's very interesting, because I think that's just about the only reference to religion in the first seven articles of the Constitution.
Well, it's interesting, because I'll tell you that I found, there are a few others, one of which is that the president is given 10 days to sign a bill, or else it becomes a bill automatically.
Except
Sundays.
It's
not 10 days, it's Sunday except.
Right, yeah.
And so I think, now that obviously doesn't require the president to take Sunday as a Sabbath, but it certainly is an acknowledgement. It's certainly an acknowledgement that the president might very well want to. So it's not blind to the fact that the majority of people in America at the time were Christians who celebrated a Sunday Sabbath.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had the statement that people shall do by oath or affirmation various statements.
Or affirmation, right.
Now, there are two parts of that. The affirmation part is a recognition that not everyone wants to swear, that you have both religious groups like Quakers that didn't swear, as well as atheists and agnostics. But at the same time, remember, it didn't say you must promise.
Mm-hmm.
Swearing was considered part. The oath was considered part of a... Madison considered oaths religious. And so it's not that the Constitution was blind to religion. It certainly did not begin with, you know, we thank God for this or that. It began with we the people.
Right.
But there's religious acknowledgement. And I think that there's a very subtle balance that I think is actually the one the framers were striving for. Not to be blind to religion, to being aware of the fact that religion mattered to so many people, but at the same time being very, very strong in not saying we are based on a particular religious belief or even a generic religious belief.
Indeed, one of the absences that is in the first seven articles that's consistent with what you say is something that we have typically inserted after the fact, and that's the presidential oath.
Yes,
it does not contain that phrase, so help me God, does it?
Not only doesn't it say, so help me God, from all the research I could do, George Washington never added it either.
Right.
And obviously there's no C-SPAN. We didn't tape it, so we don't know for sure. However, I find the convincing evidence is that for 50 years after the inauguration, nobody ever said he did. None of the newspaper accounts, none of the private letters written, none of them.
Mm-hmm.
And the most convincing evidence to me about the dog that didn't bark, as it were, was that a Senate chaplain who was trying to prove how religious and Christian George Washington was, wrote this long letter to his son describing all the religious things Washington did, including describing the inaugural address, and he didn't say Washington ever said anything other than the prescribed oath. And here's why I don't think Washington would have changed it. George Washington, and I would say sadly more than any president ever, believed in obeying the Constitution, really saw the Constitution as strictly limiting him. It is inconceivable that his first act as president would be to alter the language decided by in the Constitutional Convention. It's just inconceivable, and again, since no one said he did. But I think one of the things that happened is the first president who apparently said it is Grover Cleveland.
Right,
and
yeah, late 19th century.
And those who want to argue we're a religious nation, it kind of loses something when you say every president since Grover Cleveland. You know, it's just kind of hard to take it seriously. So they
Come
try.
On. No, let's not diss Grover Cleveland. He was a nice guy.
He's a fine guy, but, you know, I know George Washington. He was no George Washington.
You know, before we leave George Washington, I know there are several other founders we want to talk about. You used a term with him that I've used myself, and I have to agree with you 100%, underestimated. George Washington has always been remembered as a general primarily, and quite honestly, he wasn't that great a general for much of his time as a general, and he's not been remembered as a great thinker or as a great constitutionalist or as a great, in some respects, not as a great, you know, intellectual president. I think that's truly doing him a disservice. This guy was very, very bright, and he was very much aware of his constitutional obligations, and he did a heck of a job setting all those precedents in his two terms.
And I'll add one more word. Well, I mean, you look at a Thomas Jefferson, and the intelligence of that man is just beyond. It's like Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, we don't have human beings like that. So, I mean, he's doing calculus when, you know, right after Newton invents its sword. I mean, Amazing mind. But George Washington is wise.
Mm-hmm.
He has a sort of a deep wisdom. So he'll have James Madison or Alexander Hamilton do writing for him, his speeches, but he'll edit them. He'll take out stuff he doesn't like. He will listen to, you know, the team of rivals before Lincoln does. And he really understood, as a military person, he understood concepts of discipline and unity. And so I think the other thing he was extraordinarily courageous.
Oh, yes.
So he would stand up to all sorts of political groups, including the very conservative religious groups that spent. I mean, one thing that was interesting is that the clergy of the day wanted him to announce that he was Christian,
mm-hmm.
and he never did. In fact, there's a famous letter where one of them writes back how the old fox was too cunning for us. I think that he was very subtle and nuanced, traits you never think of him. And one of the problems is that he was immediately, as soon as he died, there was a battle for his legacy. And it got polluted with, you know, everyone knows about the cherry tree. But there's a host of myths and lies that grew up around him. And because he wasn't the intellectual equal, if you will, the educated equal to the Jeffersons and the Madisons of the world, I think it became easy for people to sort of underestimate him. And then once, because he did speak about religion in a certain way, those who were favoring more, if you will, separation of church and state decided he was on the wrong side. So they said, oh, we got to talk about Madison and Jefferson and not Washington. When in fact, George Washington, in his presidency, welcomed religious minorities. And he would write these letters that he knew would become public. And so suddenly Quakers, who had been hated during the Revolutionary War, became part of the American fabric because he said, you are part of who we are. Catholics, he writes this incredible letter to John Carroll, first bishop in America, about how we must be treating all people as equal. And he announces that Catholics should be considered as Christians and they're wonderful Americans. And the letter is sent to English and published in England by Catholics trying to get equality there. And the end of the editorial in the London paper is, read this and weep in embarrassment. George, and he wrote the famous letter to Jews saying that there was no, you know, that in this country there's no bigotry and, you know, you should be able to, you know, live in peace under your fig tree. And, you know, all these statements helped, like, define America as a land where, you know, what I tell people is the framers messed up race. They got race wrong. We're still correcting their mistake about how to think about equality. On religion, they largely got it right.
Mm-hmm.
Way ahead of their time, way ahead of the world. I always think I so wish they could have done in race what they did with religion, but led by George Washington's actions, I think America really began, at least, and it's not perfect. We've had ups and downs, but at the founding, there was a true sense that that religion should not divide us, and in fact should be, and religious differences should be welcomed and embraced.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking with Michael Meyerson, a professor of law at the University of Baltimore, about his marvelous new book, Endowed by Our Creator, all about the views of the founders about the relationship between church and state. Good stuff. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more to Michael Meyerson. Stick around.
We are but a moment, sunlight fading in the grass. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together, try to love one another right now. Come on, people, now smile on your brother. Everybody get together.
Well, every Everyone loves a quiz. And everyone loves Kelly. And Kelly is here, our quiz lady, to give us a quiz. So what could be better? Hi, Kelly.
Hi, how are you?
Doing extremely well. Now, who do we have on the line for our quiz today?
Mitchell.
Mitchell, where are you from, Mitchell?
Glenville, West Virginia.
Glenville, West Virginia. Well, we're so happy to have you with us. And Kelly, do you have a hard question for Mitchell today?
I have a Second Amendment question for you, Mitchell.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Do you know what the Second Amendment's about, Mitchell?
Yeah, I'll give it my best shot.
Okay. Well, we'll just see what the question is. What do you got, Kelly?
All right. According to the wording of the Second Amendment, the purpose of the people's right to keep and bear arms is A, was not given, it must be inferred from the historical context. B, was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained. C, was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects. Or D, was so that Western frontiersmen could provide themselves with a basic subsistence through hunting.
Okay, so the Second Amendment has something to do with gun rights.
Yes.
But our question goes to its rationale, right?
Exactly.
Why do we have a Second Amendment? So what were the choices again?
Sure. The purpose of the people's right to keep and bear arms, which is in the Second Amendment, is it A, was not given, it must be inferred from the historical context.
What do you think of that one? What do you think of that one, Mitchell? Was it something that wasn't given? I mean,
it was given, but I'm thinking the Supreme Court decisions in my answer here, so I'm trying to think. But I mean, it was given, but I'm not sure that's the answer choice I'm going to choose.
Okay, so we're not going to choose A, which was that there's no reason given. Okay, so we're not going to choose that for now. What was B, Kelly?
B was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained.
Did the Second Amendment say that that's the reason we have a right to keep and bear arms? Mitchell?
I don't believe so, no.
No, okay, so you don't like B either. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, then let's go on to C. What's C, Kelly?
C was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects.
That sounds like a good thing. That sounds very constitutional, in fact. What do you think about that one, Mitchell?
I'm leaning towards that one because that sounds really familiar.
Persons, papers, and effects. Secure in the... Okay, all right, that sounds like a good answer, but let's go and see what D is.
D was so that Western frontiersmen could provide themselves with a basic subsistence through hunting.
Well,
no.
You don't think
no.
so?
No.
There's no hunting in the Second Amendment?
Oh, a lot of people would say that there's hunting in the Second
Amendment.
I don't
think they need a constitutional amendment to hunt and feed themselves.
I see. All right. Well, then what answer choice do you like?
I'm going to go with C.
C, and C was once again...
C was so that people could be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects.
Okay. Is that your final answer, Mitchell?
Yeah, we'll go with that.
C is Mitchell's final answer. Kelly?
Oh, Mitchell is so close, but actually, if you go to the language of the Constitution, B is the correct answer, was so that a well-regulated militia could be maintained.
Yeah.
And this see Stewart has his Constitution in front of him right now.
Yeah. This is what we call a textual question. You know, the question was looking for what's actually written in there. And as you pointed out, Mitchell, you know, the Supreme Court subsequently can interpret, you know, various provisions of the Constitution in different ways, and sometimes that's actually in the text and sometimes it's not. But in this case, we're looking for the text, and the Second Amendment actually begins, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. And then it goes on to say, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. So there was a rationale given in the actual text of the amendment. And how important that is, of course, is for the courts to decide. But sorry about that, Mitchell.
No problem.
All right, but thank you very much for playing. Unless Kelly wants to.
Oh, should we do it?
You're the one who's always grinning at this point.
Kelly, all right, Mitchell, here's your redemption. If you could tell us what the Third Amendment is to the Constitution, you can redeem yourself and get your own, your weekly constitutional T-shirt.
This is your second chance, Mitchell. What does the Third Amendment say?
It is the most important amendment.
It's Kelly's favorite amendment. Mitchell?
He ran for the hills again.
He ran for the hills.
Nah, didn't run for the hills. I just totally drew a blank.
Well, okay, Mitchell. We're just going to have to...
Don't.
Oh, sorry about that. But, hey, look, at least you're going to get a pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier. And, Kelly, you get to tell us. What does the Third Amendment say?
No quartering of troops.
No redcoats in my
house. No redcoats in my house.
All righty. Well, Mitchell, best of luck next time.
All right. Thank you.
It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm speaking to Professor Michael Meyerson about his fascinating new book, Endowed by Our Creator, a discussion of the founders and their ideas on church-state relations. Well, Washington's fantastic, and I could talk about him all day, but let's not leave out the other folks. Let's talk about that brilliant fellow, Jefferson. In fact, you've heard that anecdote about President Kennedy, haven't you?
Yes, that it was. It was the most, the greatest number of intellects around the table in the White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone.
Right, there was a gathering of Nobel laureates, and he said this is the greatest gathering of intellects since Thomas Jefferson dined here by himself.
And I think that
he's remarkable. So what about Jefferson? What about Madison? I mean, they were bright guys, and they really are seen as sort of the vanguard of this freedom of conscience, as they call it.
Well, it's very interesting because they were a fascinating team. Thomas Jefferson helps write the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom, this extraordinarily advanced statement saying two things. As a matter of practice, that no one should be rewarded or penalized by government for their religious beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
But it begins with this preface, which is very unusual in a statute in general.
It is. It's a very unusual. Go ahead, please.
But it's the equivalent of Thomas Paine's Common Sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's saying, here's what we believe. God makes our minds free.
Yes.
If God wanted us to have one opinion, he would have given us one opinion. But it is essentially a sin to force people to have one opinion since God made our minds free. So he actually uses a religious argument to argue for total religious freedom.
Mm-hmm.
But now what I think is that James Madison, just up the road from Jefferson, he's the politician who made it happen. He's the one who got the state legislature to pass the Virginia Statute of Freedom. He's the one who writes the first draft for the First Amendment and gets it put in place. James Madison is actually like this incredibly wily politician who really establishes, as a matter of law, as opposed to a matter of principle, the American theory of freedom of religion.
Yeah, that statute for religious freedom was proposed, what, in 1779?
1779.
Right, and it wasn't passed until Madison came along and got it passed. In fact, it was when Patrick Henry was trying to reinstitute that tax.
Exactly right. What happened was James Madison defeats the tax, leads almost a year-long battle to stop this tax to help Christian teachers. He writes pamphlets, he lobbies, he does a brilliant job, and by the end of the day, there's this overwhelming public opposition to the tax for Christian teaching, and there's a sort of a sense that one of the reasons it's wrong is that it violates this principle of equality.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson's statute had been sitting dormant for 7 years, and Madison says, now. And he says, this is the time to bring it back. And within 2 months, this statute that couldn't see the light of day becomes enshrined in state law. And he just saw the opening, and he manipulated, and he lobbied, and created the political possibility for Jefferson's dream.
Right, and he wrote the Memorial and Remonstrance at that point as well. That was
the Memorial and Remonstrance. It was written anonymously by Madison. Actually, it was mostly designed against the Patrick Henry
right.
bill. But it could have been used for Jefferson's bill as well.
Right.
It's a 15 or 16 paragraph statement about why it's wrong for the government to be funding religion, favoring religion. And he said it's a wonderful document because he says, first of all, philosophically, government is not designed to know religious truths. Religiously, it's sacrilegious for government to use religion in their political arguments. Socially, it's divisive for government to favor any side, and obviously a side that can favor all Christians can favor any denomination of Christians. And he lays out, like an eloquent lawyer, step by step, why government funding of religion is dangerous and should be stopped.
You know, Michael, I love that story, and I'm so glad that you told it, because I think that entire arc from 1779, when Jefferson wrote the statute, to, what was it, 1784 or 85?
86 is actually when it passed, 86.
86, when Madison got it passed. I think that interlude, those few years, they just encapsulate the relationship. I mean, Jefferson is known as the great thinker, the lofty thoughts, the wonderful rhetoric, and quite deservedly is remembered for that. Often overlooked, and you want to talk about underestimated and underappreciated, is James Madison, who worked typically quietly and behind the scenes, or as you pointed out, anonymously when he wrote the Memorial and Remonstrance, and he actually got things done.
And it's funny because when Patrick Henry is bringing up this bill for Christian funding, Jefferson's in Europe. And he and the governor, a friend of his in Virginia, are writing back and forth. And one of them says, you know, you're not here. I'm not around. I guess it will have to be our shy little friend to take up the battle. He didn't want to, but because of his both intellect and his incredible sort of commitment to this, you read these letters of Jefferson when he was a child, just like a college student. And what his first political involvement was fury in trying to fight against the arrest of Baptist ministers who were being arrested for the crime of being Baptists. And
hold off on that. Now, let's just make sure people hear you say that. In the Commonwealth of Virginia, the official established religion was the Church of England, the Episcopal Church, and Baptists were persecuted.
Oh, persecuted, arrested for the crime of preaching. And their religion. And James Madison goes by the jail, these people are preaching, and you have people right outside actually listening to the preaching, which was driving the Virginian government crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And Madison is seeing these people in jail, and he writes to a colleague, a college classmate of his who's living in Pennsylvania, how I long to breathe the free air of Pennsylvania. This just struck him at his core. And again, from his childhood image is this sense of religious persecution. And Baptists had been persecuted in Massachusetts, came down to Virginia where they continued to be. And in fact, one of the heroes of my story is a Baptist minister named John Leland,
mm-hmm.
Who basically refused to support the Constitution until Madison promised to basically put in a First Amendment, promised to make sure there was explicit protection for religious freedom.
Okay, now let's explain that just a minute. Now, Madison is justly considered the father of the Constitution, the father of the Bill of Rights, but he had actually opposed the Bill of Rights because he didn't think it was necessary, and he thought it would be dangerous to enumerate certain rights and possibly exclude other rights. But after the ratification debates and after that demand kept being made by the Anti-Federalists, Madison eventually came around and said, okay, we're going to have a Bill of Rights. And so that's the point at which he said, okay, let's protect freedom of conscience.
Let's explicitly protect freedom of conscience.
Right.
He would have argued that Congress had no power over religion,
right.
So it wasn't really necessary.
That's why he didn't think it was necessary, because we had these limited enumerated powers in the new national government. So he was a latecomer to the Bill of Rights, but then once he adopted it, he adopted it whole hog.
And in fact, when he goes to Congress, no one else wants to even talk about it.
Right.
They all say, oh, we have an economy we have to deal with and all these other issues. And he said, no, if we want to unify the nation, many people who oppose the Constitution, the so-called Anti-Federalists, had a very valid concern. And John Leland, the Baptist minister, is one of these people who was very strong in saying, we can't have a safe government unless we have specific protections for freedom. Number one, liberty of conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And what I like about John Leland, and again, he's my other, like, newfound hero,
mm-hmm.
is that he is a deeply, classically conservative religious person. His writings and his preaching are all about very classic religious doctrine. Yet, he believed that his religious freedom could not impose on any others. He would argue that it is, you know, what my favorite line. He said, when he sees a man working on the Sabbath, he gets sad. But when he sees the sheriff arrest that man, he gets angry.
Good heavens, how enlightened. In fact, that harkens all the way back to Roger Williams, doesn't it?
In fact, yes. In fact, after Roger Williams, he is the next great American religious leader who could understand the idea of universalism. And what impresses me is that a lot of religious leaders who were being discriminated against wanted freedom for their kind.
Mm-hmm.
What Leland says is when government is...
Yeah, I'm sorry to interrupt you, Michael, but I recently came across a controversy down in Clay County, Florida, where a preacher and a local high school principal said straight out, the First Amendment only protects Christianity.
Oh, and sadly, there have been people throughout American history who will try to say that.
Yeah, okay.
And because they don't even see other religions as valid religions, you know. And let's face it, if you look at modern politics, you know, the attack on whether Mormonism is a real religion or a real Christian religion is the same flavor as whether Catholics or Christians are a real religion or whether, you know, all these other questionable, you know, Hindus, Muslims, it's all sort of the same. And John Leland, okay, here's what he says, and it's one of these extraordinary moments. John Adams, our hero, is arguing that Massachusetts should be able to tax for religion because funding religion and paying for governmental aid to religion sort of fulfills the tender consciousness of the individuals in Massachusetts. It's a way of like, listening to the people.
Huh.
And John Leland said, would the gentleman from Massachusetts be so satisfied if the majority followed basically the teachings of Jews or Muslims? Would he be willing to refrain from pork or wine just because they do? And he spoke about the children of Abraham, the children of Ishmael, with this respect, like they were a valid religion, and how could you treat your religion as better?
Hmm.
And so he understood, and I think he becomes a very close friend of Jefferson. One of the things I hate about modern discussion of religion and church and state is this feeling that if you are deeply religious, you must have one side. If you are agnostic, you must have another view. And I'm convinced that it is certainly possible to have personal religious views that don't trigger or don't signal what you believe the government's role is.
Hmm.
And I would argue that sort of fittingly, that the growth of baptism, that Baptists as a religion in America flows directly from the fact that government wasn't helping them. That basically after the First Amendment, you know, gets passed, after America is created in the early 1800s, you have all these new territories, and people who are preaching religion and trying to teach religion are able to go at it. It's very much like the marketplace of ideas. And the fact, I mean, I think it is not a coincidence that America is considered more religious than England, which still has a Church of England.
Right. Very interesting. And of course, one of the ironies in all of this, when you talk about the early Baptists in the United States, is that, of course, at least some Baptists now are some of those who are the most accommodationist and who are the most willing to ignore the principle of separation of church and state. And it was their religion that was persecuted.
Well, I think what I think every religion is filled with a whole host of different people, but I think the lesson is you too were once a minority.
Right. I mean, think about the Catholics. I mean, that we now have a majority of Catholics on the Supreme Court. That would have been unthinkable back in 1780.
You have six Catholics and three Jews. I suspect the Constitution would not have been ratified if people known that was going to happen.
What an outcome. What will happen to us now?
Well, let's hear it for the First Amendment. But I think there is always a tendency for people to want the government to reflect their faith. I think that's just, but I think it's, I mean, one of the things that's interesting about American history is the possibility that Madison and Jefferson didn't win. That in fact, that after they leave office, you have these waves of like religious fervor where suddenly, you know, you're putting, you know, religious statements on coins during the Civil War, or you're adding, you know, One Nation Under God in the 1950s, where basically it's never been settled in stone, the relationship between government and religion. And I think that Madison once said that he was afraid of writing a First Amendment for religion because he wasn't sure the people would support protection as broadly as he wanted.
Yes, and indeed he proposed that not only would there be a federal or a national non-establishment clause, he wanted to do the same thing in the states, didn't he?
Absolutely, and he lost.
Yes, he lost
in Philadelphia,
that.
He lost again, and it wasn't until after the Civil War that sort of the Bill of Rights became nationalized.
Now, let me clarify that. The federal Constitution, U.S. Constitution, says that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. So there's going to be no established official national religion. But at that time, in 1791, many states had official religions, and Madison wanted to abolish them.
Absolutely, and was unable to. But
yeah.
And here's where one of my sort of thoughts, which is that when the Constitution is created, and the way you just described it, there was a sense that the rules that apply to the states shouldn't apply to the nation,
mm-hmm.
that the nation could be viewed differently. So George Washington would say, in the United States, there is no bigotry, and then say he was sorry that it still was around in some of the different states. So here's sort of one of my favorite stories about this. When the Constitution is being ratified state by state, towards the end, as they were trying to get to the final, they needed 9 to make it official, Pennsylvania has this enormous rally to celebrate their ratification and urge others to do so. And it's this monster rally, 20,000 people marching. And first of all, you have all these religious leaders marching hand in hand. You have Catholic, Jew, Protestant of different faiths, and they're arm in arm. So that's 14 members of different religions and denominations marching together. Not only that, when they get to the end of their march, it's this giant park, and there are hundreds of tables filled with food. One of those tables has kosher food.
Wow.
And this is at a time, by the way, when Jews can't serve in the Pennsylvania legislature. And yet there was a sense that somehow the United States was going to be different than the individual states. And so actually religious freedom develops nationally in a far more clear way than it does in the states. Maryland in the 1820s has what's called the Jew Bill, where they're trying to let Jews serve in the legislature. And it takes many years into the 1820s until that finally happens.
The Jew Bill.
Yes.
The title alone is provocative.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this is an interesting discussion. I don't think I've ever talked about Jew bills before, but we talk about lots of interesting things with Michael Meyerson, author of Endowed by Our Creator, a study of church-state relations as thought about by the founders of our great nation. After the break, we'll come back and talk a little bit about what's happening this week at Montpelier, and then we'll talk a little bit more with Mike Meyerson, and then... I have a surprise for you, so don't touch that dial.
When all the broken-hearted people living in the world agree, there will be an answer, let it be. But though they may be parted, there is still a chance that they will see.
Okay, Kelly Carmichael, tell us what's happening this week at Montpelier.
My second favorite time of the year.
Your second favorite time of the year.
So it's not Constitution Day is my favorite time of the year.
Of course, it is all of our favorite time of year. Of course it is, but what's your second favorite time?
Our Montpelier Hunt Races.
The Hunt Races? What is a Hunt Race?
It will be our 78th running of the Montpelier Hunt Races, which is a tradition thanks to Marion DuPont Scott.
Oh, that's right. She was a big horse lady.
She was into racing and horse races, a tradition she started, and then we've continued that tradition.
In fact, there is a racetrack right out in front of the mansion.
Steeplechase and a dirt racetrack. So it's a very good time. It's all day. November 3rd, starting gates open at 9 a.m. A lot of folks will come, bring their chairs. We'll tailgate, watch the horses race.
This is a Saturday?
Saturday.
Saturday, November?
November 3rd.
November 3rd, starting at 9 a.m. And how long does the hunt races typically last?
You know, it usually goes to about 3 or 4. It's a good all-day experience.
It's a good all-day experience, but still finishes early enough you can drive home at the end of the day. And I imagine there are a lot of horses here, too. A lot of horse trailers.
Yep, a lot of horses, a lot of vendors, a lot of arts and crafts. The actual first horse race usually starts around 12:30 or 1.
Right. Why is this your second favorite? Why is it your second?
You know, it's just the leaves have changing color. The temperature is really kind of nice and cool and crisp. Uh-huh. It's just a beautiful time to be with friends and family. And
I imagine there are lots of vendors and lots of wine and lots of just.
Though pluses. I won't be enjoying the libations this year.
That's true because
I'm going to be having a baby in a couple weeks.
You're going to be having a baby. Okay, well, now, see, you just revealed this completely. I was going to make a big announcement at some point, but the baby is far enough along, so no, it's going to be in November, is it?
It's going to be November.
Okay, well, we'll have to start doing regular baby updates. We're going to have to start calling you the quiz mom instead of the quiz lady. We'll see. Okay, well, thanks, Kelly. Even though you're not going to be there this year, or at least not enjoying the libations, we encourage everybody else to come out. And that's, once again, Saturday, November...
November 3rd. You can learn more at montpelierraces.org.
Montpelierraces.org. Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
It's your weekly constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. Now let's finish up our discussion with Michael Meyerson, all about his new book, Endowed by Our Creator.
One of the things I think people have to know is that it's like talking about slavery and race. I mean, I am very patriotic. I think the founders were brilliant, but it's not a perfect history. I mean, I think Catholics have to know that, you know, just the history of animosity. I mean, they do know it. But I think all people have to know this, that there's good and bad. And one of the things I dislike about those who want to teach religion in schools is that if you don't teach the full truth, the good and the bad, the unity and the division, the love and the hatred, then you're just lying. I mean, I think you have to have the courage, and the goal of my book was to have the courage of that conviction.
Very interesting. Now, the one of these founders that we really haven't talked about, you forgot my favorite, the guy you'd most like to have a beer with, Benjamin Franklin.
Benjamin Franklin is so far ahead of his time. You know, don't get, he's way older than all these other people we've been talking about. So he's before the revolution. And he just has this vision that everyone should be able to sort of follow their religion. And so he gave money to every single religion building a building in Philadelphia. He writes a check to the synagogue to build for it. He helps build... George Whitefield, from the First Great Awakening, is this preacher comes down, and finally all the other churches refuse to let him in because he's stealing their business. So Ben Franklin helps build a building, and he describes the building as having no religious symbols so that even a Muslim could come in and pray. This is unbelievably, like, welcoming. And my other favorite story is that in his diary, he meets John Carroll as they try to negotiate with Canada to try to get them to be on our side during the revolution. Doesn't work, but they become friends. Then in the late 1780s, you see a letter in his Ben Franklin's diary saying, well, the Pope took my advice and they're going to appoint John Carroll bishop. So at a time when most Americans hate Catholics, you know, consider them superstitious murderers, he's becoming friends with the Pope. And it just was this sense of decency. And now, interestingly enough, he wanted to start the Constitutional Convention with a prayer. He is not unreligious.
Right.
I mean, he may question a lot of doctrines. He didn't know about the Trinity and other things. But in many ways, he felt very sad that he couldn't get people to agree to pray. He thought that'd be unifying and uplifting.
Right, but yet that doesn't necessarily mean he's a believer in any particular sect. In fact, I once heard a story that he was practically on his deathbed, and he received a letter asking him if he believed in the divinity of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And his response was, well, you know, I've never really thought about it, but since I'm so close to finding out, I think I'll just let the matter rest.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. And, of course, he's incredibly clever. And,
uh-huh.
And I mean, they didn't have the word at the time, but he's very snarky.
Fantastic fellow. But no, one last issue I want to get to before we run out of time is I seem to recall that your thought is that there was great tolerance for agnostics and even for atheists. Now, how do you reconcile that with the acknowledgement of religion and its importance generally as a unifying factor? Where do the atheists fit in? Where do the agnostics fit in?
Well, when Thomas Jefferson is fighting for the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom along with Madison, there was an attempt to take the phrase the plan of the holy author of our religion and add the word Jesus Christ to that.
Mm-hmm.
They defeated that, Madison and Jefferson did. And Jefferson writes, now this is everybody. It's the Hindu. It's the pagan. In other words, their view, just like endowed by our Creator, they understood that language could be non-doctrinaire. Now, I think that some of them would have trouble with atheists, but even Washington once writes this letter saying, I need a carpenter. I don't care if he's, you know, Protestant, Catholic, Jewish, or atheist. I just want someone who can do the job. I think they began to almost have that Martin Luther King sense, the content of their character, because they saw that there were wonderful Christians and evil Christians and wonderful people of each religion.
Right.
And so, you know, so I think that they were able to see that you could live a Christian life without being Christian is basically what some of them finally realized.
Well, that certainly seemed to be Jefferson's perspective, since he cut out all the divinity stuff from his version of the Bible and simply kept the gospel stuff.
Absolutely. But again, I decided that I didn't really care about their personal religion,
mm-hmm.
because what their faith wasn't the same as their position on the relationship between government and religion.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, again, if you look at the people we've been talking about, they understood and they saw.
Very interesting. Well, before we run out of time, any final thoughts, any summation?
It's just that when you hear people quoting from what the founders say, make sure you read all the quotes, because there are pros and cons, and there's too much cherry picking, and I think all of us have an obligation to be willing to listen to opinions that we don't agree with.
Well, Michael Meyerson, thank you so very much for your time and for discussing with us your newest book, Endowed by Our Creator. Now, is that's available now? People can get it
at
the bookstore?
It's on Amazon.com and other bookstores, Endowed by Our Creator, The Birth of Religious Freedom in America.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you so much. I had a great interview.
Wasn't that a fascinating discussion with Michael Meyerson about his new book, Endowed by Our Creator? He's just as nice in person as he sounds on the radio, so I urge you to run out to your bookstore or get on Kindle or however you buy books and go get a copy of this, because it's every bit as entertaining in print as it is through the airwaves. Now let's take a moment and do our Madison Minute.
In 1791, James Madison befriended Italian sculptor Giuseppe Ciaracchi, who had moved to Philadelphia to carve a monument to the American Revolution. Madison described Ciaracchi, whom he knew well, as an artist celebrated by his genius. Similarly, Ciaracchi described Madison as having the eminent genius to draw the plan of the present Constitution. After his initial meeting with Madison, Ciaracchi wrote that he would honor my chisel with cutting his bust. When Ciaracchi discovered flaws in the alabaster for Madison's piece, he salvaged his work by transforming the bust into a profile relief mounted on a marble roundel. The medallion is considered a great likeness of Madison. Ciaracchi was a revolutionary figure himself, who spent his final years exiled from Italy because of his radical sympathies with contemporary Jacobin uprisings. He was eventually executed in France. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blaylock.
And now I have a special treat for you. One of the many cool things you'll encounter if you ever visit Montpelier, and I urge you to do so, is that they have interpreters there. Many different interpreters, but the biggest of them all are James and Dolly Madison, and I've met them both. And they're fascinating people, and I had the real pleasure of speaking to the woman who interprets Dolly Madison for you. In fact, she's not merely an interpreter. She's a very learned lady, and I've had the great pleasure of working together with her on important projects at Montpelier. And recently, I had the chance to sit down and speak with her. Her name is Lynn Yuzel.
I have the best job description it is possible to have.
Tell me, please.
I am the scholar in residence at the Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier.
My, that does sound very impressive. What does the scholar in residence do?
Beats me.
Okay, you'll have to get a little bit more specific.
Well, they sick me on all sorts of different projects. And so at one point, I may be developing an online course. At another time, I may be managing the posts that get placed on our online
the blogs,
site.
Yeah.
No, the site for the context.
Oh, okay, right.
The notes for the convention. They may be having me write blogs, but that hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. And there are numerous other scholarly pursuits. Whenever they have a scholarly question about the making of the Constitution, I'm the go-to person.
That is nifty now. How does one get a job like this? What is your background?
Well, I was doing some teaching, and I had some fellowships at a couple of the universities. I came from Texas, actually, which is where I did my graduate work at the mm-hmm. University of Dallas.
Right.
And I did some teaching at Baylor University.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had a couple of fellowships, one at the University of Virginia and another at the University of Richmond.
Right. You have a PhD in?
Politics.
Politics, okay.
Right. So I am a constitutional scholar, but I study it from the perspective of political philosophy, mm-hmm. not from the perspective of law.
Okay. Very good. Well, that's certainly, there's a lot of political philosophy and a lot of history in the Constitution. Okay. So you've got your PhD, you've done all this work, and then how did you actually get to the point where you and Montpelier got together?
Well, it started out with me working on a contract basis. I was doing individual projects. I was one of the scholars that worked on the introductory course for the Constitution, an online course that we launched last year.
Mm-hmm.
And
an excellent course, by the way.
Thank you. I must say,
I've worked through several of the episodes, and I never get all the answers right. I always learn new things, and so it's very, very valuable. But please go on.
Well, Montpelier, I think, got tired of me sending them invoices, and therefore they finally offered me a full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's nice. Mm-hmm.
And there is one other thing that I had created a niche for myself, which probably will not be attached to this job description ever after, but it has nonetheless been rolled into the scholar in residence this time.
A niche. And what is this niche?
I am also Mrs. Madison.
You are Dolly Madison in the flesh. That's right. I knew I recognized you from somewhere. Okay, so you actually come on the Montpelier grounds and do what?
Right, this began because I started giving salons here at Montpelier. And the idea was that Mrs. Madison spent nearly 20 years with her husband in his retirement going over his notes of the Constitutional Convention, editing them, helping to copy them, soliciting other people for more information about that convention. And therefore, because James Madison was the last living member of the convention, she would have been the second greatest authority on the Constitutional Convention living at that time. And she would be an excellent person to give presentations about the Constitutional Convention.
Well, now, that's fascinating in and of itself, because I'm sure most people have no idea that Dolly was that intimately involved with editing the notes, etc. But there's still a leap between talking about Dolly and emphasizing her role and actually pretending to be Dolly. At what point did that happen? When did that occur? Was that your idea?
It was my idea. I did not answer an ad in the paper for that. Uh-huh. I created the position myself. And for me, it was a way, not for Dolly to talk about Dolly, because Dolly would not do that. Mm-hmm. She hated to talk anything that smacked of egoism. Mm-hmm. But she would talk about her husband. And therefore, this was a way of bringing the subject of James Madison's and his role as father of the Constitution to a more popular audience, to make it entertaining, to make it humorous, and at the same time, to make it educational.
Well, did this just happen organically? I mean, were you giving a presentation one time and you were saying things, well, Dolly might say this and Dolly might say that, and you just found yourself slipping into character? I mean, how did that happen?
No, it really happened because what is now the interim president of Montpelier, Sean O'Brien, was showing me the room that he called the Constitution Room in Montpelier and saying that he would like to have lectures there for the general public. And the sticking point for me was trying to imagine the family on their vacation voluntarily deciding to go to a lecture on the Constitution.
I have law students who are reluctant to go to class, and they're paying money for the privilege, so I get your point. So you were looking for a hook. You were looking for something that would make this more attractive to the average American family on vacation.
That's exactly it. So the family who would not go to a scholarly lecture on the Constitution would go to meet Dolly Madison.
What a wonderful idea. And so now you greet them in costume, and you then say, well, as my husband and I were discussing, and then you just kind of go off and give them the Constitution with a spoonful of sugar, as it were.
Exactly right.
Isn't that the coolest thing? Dolly Madison as a hook, as an inducement to constitutional education, and no one better to do it than Lynn Yazelle. Now, my interview with Lynn lasted far longer than I've had an opportunity to play today, and so I'll be bringing her back on a future episode or two as the opportunity permits. But rest assured, she is every bit as nice in person as she is on the radio, and I encourage you to go out and see her at Montpelier. So thanks very much to Dr. Lynn Yazelle. Thanks also to our other guest, Michael Meyerson of the University of Baltimore Law School, and who told us all about his fascinating new book on church-state relations during the founding era, Endowed by Our Creator. Run out to your bookstore and get a copy of that as soon as you can. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineers are Larry Mayer and Bob Hoffman. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn about it.
We've just been to the wedding of Mr. Church and Miss State. Well, the groom was dressed in his Sunday best. He made everybody nervous. He'd been named the head of the brand new Federal Faith Enforcement Service. Standing at his side were the groomsmen, the four doomsmen of the apocalypse.
Waiting for the...